Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassami. So tonight I am going to say a few words about the first of the four protective meditations, because we are at the beginning of Vasa, the rains retreat, and we're studying the Satipatthana, the four foundations of mindfulness, the Sutta on the four foundations of mindfulness. And Ayananda Bodhi, one of the senior nuns here, thought that it would be helpful for us to begin with the protective meditations as a way of nourishing ourselves before getting into the sutta in more depth. And they're called the protective meditations because of that, because they are not because it's some kind of special talisman or devotional protection, but a protection actually from our own ignorance, from our own delusion, from our own difficulty in receiving the Dhamma. So the first of the four is Buddha Nusati, means recollection of the Buddha, or mindfulness. Sati is mindfulness, mindfulness of the Buddha. And the other three are the cultivation of metta, of loving kindness, the asubha, study of the unattractive aspects of the body, and Maranasati, the mindfulness of death. So today I want to talk just a little bit about Buddha Nusati, the recollection of the Buddha, or the mindfulness of the Buddha. And so I want to say my personal experience with the traditional Theravada style of mindfulness of the Buddha is fairly recent. So I don't have a lot of experience with that, but I'm going to go through briefly the how that practice is done, and then I hope to say a few words about mindfulness of the Buddha in terms of my own day-to-day practice, my own experience of the Buddha, in the hopes of giving you all some different perspectives, perhaps, or some different facets of this practice. So the mindfulness of the Buddha Nisati, is a practice that is intended to develop faith in the Buddha, or confidence in the Buddha's teachings. So when we talk about faith in Buddhism, typically we are not talking about blind faith in some kind of belief, but rather a confidence in the Buddha as a teacher who had an insight that we can begin to understand and cultivate in ourselves. So there's a very traditional chant, usually just called Itipiso, which is the first couple of syllables, but it's the recollections of the Buddha. Itipiso bhagava arahang samma sambuddho vijja charana sampanno Sugato loka vidu anuttaro purisa dhamma sarati sata deva manusana buddho bhagavati. So that's nine. Those are nine characteristics of the Buddha. So tipiso just means like, and thus he, Bhagava, the Blessed One. I'll say more about that because it's repeated at the end. So I'll say more about that at the end. And then it starts with Arahang is the first attribute. So the is assumed. The verb to be is assumed in there. And Arahang is just a particular grammatical version of the word that might be more familiar to folks, arahat or arahant, depending on Pali or Sanskrit pronunciation. And an arahat is someone who has eliminated the greed, hatred and delusion, or lust and anger and ignorance. So eliminated the unwholesome tendencies. Eliminated completely the conceit of a separate, independent self. That's an arahant, arahat. And samma sambuddho means perfectly awakened. Buddho means awakened. And sam is self-awakened. And samma is perfect. So the Buddha was self-awakened, not in the sense that he didn't have any teachers. He studied with Alara Kalama and with Udaka Ramaputta, two of the very well-known meditation teachers of his time. But he kind of got to the point where they indicated to him that he had mastered their teachings, and he still felt that that had not really resolved the question of how to end suffering. And so he developed his own path to the resolution of suffering, and that's why he is self-awakened, because he developed his own path after having done those studies. So to be, again, to be perfectly self-awakened, to be an awakened being, is to have completely eradicated any form of ignorance or any form of misunderstanding about the nature of our human existence. And that particular quality of his self-awakening, I think, says something about the Buddha's very, very strong capacity to persist, that he really didn't let himself be taken off the seat until he had arrived at the real final end of suffering. So there's a certain strength of the Buddha that comes forth in that particular attribute. And then vijja charana sampanno. So vijja is knowledge, and charana is conduct, and sampanno means perfected. So he is perfect in conduct and understanding, is how that phrase is usually translated, especially around here. So his conduct was said to be completely peaceful, non-argumentative, right? He was completely ethical, pure in his ethical conduct, and pure in his knowledge, meaning that he had And so sometimes I want to say this part about the pure knowledge is sometimes taken to mean that the Buddha was omniscient. Sometimes you hear that. But there's actually a sutta in which the Buddha is asked, he says, one of the monks approaches him and says, you know, people are saying that you are omniscient. And he specifically says, no. He says specifically, I'm not. I have these three knowledges that most people do not have, the tivijja. And the three knowledges are those, are his complete, perfect insight into his past lives. So hundreds and thousands of past lives, completely understanding who he was and where he was and how that life arose and came to an end and how the next life arose and so on. And then the second knowledge is the knowledge of how that function, if you will, how the function of karma works for all beings, not just the Buddha's own past lives, but how all beings fare with respect to their karma, their actions, and the results of those actions. And then finally, the third knowledge was a knowledge of the destruction of the taints. So it's an interesting kind of reflection once the so-called taints or the defilements or the unwholesome aspects of being have fallen away, have been destroyed, then there's a reflective knowledge of knowing that, knowing what's missing. Actually, it's like another step after the enlightenment, this kind of reflective knowledge. So that was the kind of knowledge that the Buddha had. And then Sugato literally means one who fares well. Or Bhikkhu Bodhi, let's just translate it as the well-gone one. So it means that he fares well in the world. He has a life of ease in the world, because of his complete understanding and harmony with reality. And then Loka Vidu means the knower of the worlds. So the Buddha very clearly described in this part of this knowledge that he learned about how beings fare in their karmic paths. He also saw very clearly the different kinds of existence, the different kinds of planes of existence. So that's one way, one aspect of knowing the worlds. But actually the other part which I appreciate about this particular attribute, the knower of the worlds, is also knower of the inner worlds. So the Buddha was a brilliant teacher, in part because he could actually see the capacities and the tendencies of everyone that he came into contact with. He could actually see their inner workings. And so it's at this point where we shift, where the attributes shift from the Buddha's own attributes as a result of his practice to the way that he interacts with the world. So the next one is Sattadeva Manusanam. So he's there's a special kind of honorific word for teacher of devas, deities, male and female, and all sorts of other non-gendered deities, and humans. So based on this ability to encounter beings and understand their capacities and their tendencies, he would respond with exactly the right teaching. He could offer exactly the teaching that would be the perfect next thing for the person's liberation. And then we have Budo, again, awakened one, and that Budo is actually sometimes used in the Thai Theravada tradition, the tradition, the lineage in which the senior sisters here were trained, sometimes as a mantra, Budo. And it literally just means awake. And the Buddha was awake in the sense of the first fully enlightened being. But it also means that he is a beacon of awakening or a beacon of enlightenment in the world. That through his life, even now when he has gone to Mahaparinirvana, meaning he doesn't go through the cycle of birth and death any longer, doesn't go through the karmic cycle any longer, he's still awakening beings. The fact that we're here practicing. Right? And so the Bhagava, again, this is a word that was and still is used in India for a holy person, a spiritually accomplished person. And it has this connotation, it has an implication of ultimate compassion. That the Buddha accomplished all of these things and was this way in the world because of his perfection of the practice of compassion, lifetime after lifetime after lifetime, and fully in this very lifetime as well. So we are the recipients, if you will, of those waves of compassion that are still happening in the world as a result of the Buddha's life. So one of the ways that this practice is done is by visualizing, sitting and visualizing the Buddha, and then reciting, recalling these qualities. And I just want to say that if you want to follow along or if you want to remind yourself of the qualities here as I shift into slightly different mode. Oh, and I missed one. I was thinking, well, I missed one in there somewhere. Anuttaro Purisa Dhamma Sarati. So I recited it, but then I forgot to describe it. So that one comes after Loka Vidu, after Knower of the Worlds. Anuttaro Purisa Dhammati. So Anuttaro means unsurpassed. Purisa is beings. Dhamma is not the Dhamma that we normally know with an H. Dhamma without an H. And it means untamed or untrained. So, sarati is a word that means a charioteer or a horse trainer. So the Buddha, it's a metaphor for the Buddha as a trainer of untrained beings, untamed people. So it points at his willingness and his skill, actually, to teach all sorts of people with all sorts of concerns, confusions, even anger or ill will toward him, all sorts of disrespect for him. He was challenged. The Buddha was challenged in many ways, even after his enlightenment. So it points to his patience and his willingness to an ability to train everyone. So anyway, returning to what I was saying, the practice is often done in the traditional Theravada style practice, bringing an image of the Buddha to mind, an image that is demonstrating some of these qualities. So the Buddha's blissfulness and his compassion and his ease in the world and his great wisdom. And so I brought an image that I particularly like just to share with you all, and if you want to pass this around. This is, so in the early Buddhist scheme, it's called Buddha Rupa, means it's a statue or a form of what the Buddha may have looked like. So we don't really know, because these things weren't actually done until many, many hundreds of years after the Buddha's time. During the Buddha's lifetime, there were not statues and things of him that represented him. He was actually represented by things like his footprint or by the wheel of Dhamma, because he was the turner of the wheel of Dhamma. But nowadays we have many different ways of depicting the Buddha, and sometimes those can be helpful in terms of our connecting to these qualities of the Buddha. And then, as I was saying earlier, thinking about receiving this as part of the Buddha's compassion, receiving this, these experiences of what the Buddha was like as part of the Buddha's compassion, but also as a way to sort of water the seeds of our own capacity for these qualities. To water the seeds. And nourish the part of ourself that is also the Buddha student. The Buddha's disciple. So, and then calling to mind the different qualities. Sometimes you might do fewer than the whole nine of them. Bhikkhu Bodhi suggests starting with the nine and then working down to three and then working down to one. That's one way of thinking about it. Or just picking one that speaks to you and doing that for a while and then seeing how that goes, seeing if you shift to another one. But as I said earlier, what I would also like to do is talk a little bit about my day-to-day practice or experience of the Buddha, the recollection of the Buddha, because I think that's also a way that we can begin to water these seeds and we can begin to experience ourselves as students of the way, as students who are walking the path that the Buddha so compassionately set forth. So, for example, one way that I often connect with the Buddha as an incredibly skillful teacher is when we go out on alms round. So we go out to the farmer's market and we take our bowls. And when I was in Japan, we also did alms round. They're a little bit different, but it's done in many different Buddhist traditions. But here, at Aloka Vihara, we go to the farmer's market and we take our bowls and we stand there and wait to have a conversation with someone, wait for someone to approach us about what we're doing. And many times, I would say most of the time, because we don't live in a predominantly Buddhist country, and especially this part of the country, it's not really a predominantly Buddhist country, part of the country, most of the people that see us there or encounter us there don't know what these robes mean or what the bowl means or why we don't have hair or any of that, you know? So they'll approach and they'll ask or they'll say something or they'll make some kind of a guess and try to give us money. And we tell them a little bit about how we don't handle money and that we're here receiving donations of food, that we're Buddhist nuns and we're receiving donations of food. And folks will just oftentimes, just reach right in their own grocery bag and take their own groceries and put it in our bowl. Folks who are not Buddhist, folks who have never seen a Buddhist nun before in their whole life. Folks who don't know who the Buddha was, or what this teaching is, or where we live, or what we do when we get up in the morning. But there's something about the way that the Buddha set up this intimacy, this kind of being seen in the community, being totally intimate and present in the community. So the Buddha set it up such that folks, the monks and nuns, could not be hermits. They couldn't go off and live without the support of other people. So it sets up all of these wonderful ramifications, like accountability, because you are seen. And it sets up also this kind of presence of the Dharma in the world, which is not really about us personally in some way. At some level, it's a very archetypical kind of thing. So there's that aspect of it, and there's the personal aspect of it, and there's the just generosity, just the way that people's hearts open up. And somehow they meet the opportunity to give. And they feel good about it. The other day, a nun-devotee, last weekend, not today, but last Saturday, a nun-devotee and I were at the farmer's market, and there was a little girl who was feeling very shy, and she was kind of standing behind her mom's leg and kind of like peeking out and looking at us and sort of curious, but also too shy to really say anything or do anything. But then somehow, between then and 20 minutes later or so, when we were getting ready to leave, she mustered her courage and she had a bag of onions, it turns out, and came and gave it to us. Gave it to me. And then she got this huge smile on her face. And she walked away, almost like shaking her head. She walked away like, you could see, like, and I said, yeah, that's how it feels. Right? Giving. That's how it feels. Right? This incredible, incredible brilliance of the Buddha to make these things possible every single day in one way or another, you know? And so she gets that feeling in her heart and she does this wonderful thing of supporting the Dharma, even though she doesn't know what that is, and that's okay. And there's a seed planted in her about that, about her own compassionate heart, you know? Such a beautiful teaching, without saying, you know, without even my having said anything, it's a beautiful teaching that she encountered on her own, even if she never saw us at the market again. No? So for me, that's always a lovely reminder of the brilliance of the Buddha as a teacher, that he established this way of the fourfold Sangha, that there's equally important to have lay women and lay men and folks of other genders, all other genders, and monks and nuns and folks of other genders. In fact, today there's someone of non-dual gender who received their Anagarika precepts today at another monastery. So he set up this beautiful interworkings to benefit beings, even accidentally. You know? And another way that the Buddha sometimes comes into my experience, or that I have a recollection of how brilliant the Buddha was, is sometimes if I read the news and I read of someone who's lost their child, someone whose child has died, when I was in chaplaincy, I actually helped out some folks, some moms who's had lost their kids. It's incredibly painful. Incredibly, incredibly painful, and just shock is the strongest word, you know, the most clear word that can be used for what happens to someone when their child dies before them. And it calls to mind for me often the story of Kisa Gotami. So when the Buddha was teaching, there was a woman whose son had died, and her son was very important to her. It was arguably the most important being in her world, because her family situation was quite difficult, because of her having come from a lower social position than the family that she married into. And as an infant, the son died very suddenly. And she clung to the baby's body. She carried around this baby and went around asking people for help, for some medicine for her baby, because she couldn't accept his death. And finally, some compassionate person said to her, you know, I cannot help you with this, but I think you could go and ask the Buddha for his help, because the Buddha could help you with your son. And so she came to where the Buddha was teaching, and he was in the middle of a discourse, and she interrupted him and asked him to bring her son back to life, or to give her some medicine for her son, actually, was what she requested, as the story goes, as I recall. And he said, well, I can help you with your son, but first you need to go and you need to collect some mustard seeds from a family that has not experienced death. So mustard seeds, I don't know if you recognize them, but they're these tiny little things. And it's a thing that in this part of northern India, probably every single household would have had, or most of them. Not a hard thing to find. And so she went to the first house, and she said, I need some mustard seeds to make medicine for my baby. Will you help me? And they said, of course, yeah, we have mustard seeds and we're happy to give them to you. And she said, okay, well, I can only accept them from you if you haven't experienced a death in this household. Have you ever experienced a death in this household? And they said, well, of course. The dead outnumber the living. The dead outnumber the living. And so she said, okay, okay, I can't accept your mustard seeds, thank you. But I have to go on to the next house. And so she went from house to house. I don't know for how long she went from house to house until she finally realized that she wasn't going to find a household that hadn't been touched by death. And then she was able to go and bury her baby and go back to the Buddha to receive his teachings and heal from that experience. And so, again, for me, the brilliance of the Buddha and the compassion of the Buddha, that he, in such a simple way, showed her that she needed to both accept the reality of her own life, the specific conditions of her own life, and that she could do that in the context of our shared humanity, our shared commonality, our shared experiences of joys and pains, of birth and death. So skillfully, so simply, that she had to walk her own path to finding that out. As we all do, have to walk our own path to finding out both of those two aspects, if we are going to be able to take in and really practice with our lives, the situations of our lives. And finally, one last story about my own experience of Buddha, recollection of the Buddha, Buddha Nisati. You know, I think that over time, over the centuries, people became acutely aware of the absence of the Buddha's presence in the world, and there came to be some ways of speaking about him and teaching about him that almost seemed to deify him. I think this is common in some of the later Buddhist traditions that evolved out of the earlier teachings. And so there have been times in my practice life over the many, many years of feeling like the Buddha was such an amazing human being, also that he is incredibly distant from me. Like, I can't even imagine taking a step in his direction. And then again, we have the suttas and we have the stories of what the teacher was like as a Buddha, as what the Buddha was like as a teacher. And in particular, there's one story about the Buddha called the Simsapa Sutta. The Simsapa is a kind of tree in the area of India where the Buddha taught. And it's, the story goes that the Buddha was with a group of monks and they were in the forest, a big forest full of Simsapa trees. And the Buddha turns to the monks and he says, are there many, many, many leaves in the forest, in the Simsapa forest, dear monks? And the monks say, well, yes. Yes. Bhante, yes. Bhagavai, yes. There are many, many leaves in the forest. And the Buddha picks up a handful of leaves off the floor of the forest and he says, "Are there many leaves in my hand?" And the monks say, "Well, no, there aren't that many leaves in your hand." And he says, "And just so, the things that I know, have come to know, are like the leaves in the forest. But the things that you need to know in order to be fully liberated are like the leaves in my hand." Like, what compassion, what thoughtfulness, right? Talk about understanding the dynamics, the inner workings of a human being, and meeting that in a compassionate way. You don't need to know the whole forest. You just need to know the leaves in my hand. Beautiful. So thoughtful, so kind, so encouraging. So I leave us on that note, I hope, a note of some encouragement and some watering, some nourishing of our own seeds of compassion, our own seeds of walking the path of the Buddha way. Thank you all for listening. We have maybe about 5 minutes if anybody had any comments or questions or reflections that they would like to share about how they recollect the Buddha. No, seems like it's going to be quiet. Okay. All right, well, thank you all again for your presence and your attention this evening. And we will just bow out, call it a night.